Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org. And URS, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical support to public agencies and private companies. URS.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Craig Miller in for Scott Schaefer. Coming up, young people around the state react to the George Zimmerman verdict, turning their anger to activism. And it's billed as the world's biggest solar farm, and it's set to open in California, but it wasn't easy getting to this point.
I think it has been tough. It's been personally painful. We are very good at stopping things. We aren't very good at building things.
Plus, the heat is on businesses that have people working outdoors.
These guys do all the work and get us our product that we need to sell. And without these guys, you know, where are we? We're nowhere. So we do everything we can to take care of them.
And we sample the wine from a Native American vintner with deep roots in the Central Coast. It's the California Report. Protests over the outcome of Florida's George Zimmerman trial will continue around California this weekend. In Oakland this week, protesters shut down a major freeway. There were arrests in Los Angeles for destruction of property. But as Deepa Fernandez reports from KPCC, the verdict has also rallied young people to call for change using more constructive tools of protest.
Freestyle about Trayvon Martin.
I'll do a beat and then come in when you feel ready, all right?
In a community art space in LA's Crenshaw District, a group of teenagers has gathered for a meeting of their hip-hop arts group. It's the first time they've met since the Zimmerman verdict, and they have something to say.
Rest in peace to Trayvon. Your death won't be in vain. I know your family's feeling a lot of pain, and it's kind of crazy that my people are going insane. 400 years of oppression. I know your parents are probably going through a deep depression, but I'm in a session for you, and I feel what we are going through. I hope you're looking down and you have a smile on your face.
My name's Lee Greenwood. I go to Catch High, and I'm 15.
Greenwood says Trayvon has been all he and his friends have been talking about these last few days. They think the jury was wrong, and they want to do something about it.
Because that could have been me. That could have been my brother. That could have been my friend just walking down. He was minding his own business. And, you know, that could have been anybody. That could have been any black kid.
Greenwood and his friends have been watching the news nonstop for weeks.
So we talked about everything that happened throughout the jury and all that, and it just didn't make sense to us.
Today, these young rappers stand on a makeshift stage. They act, recite poetry, and freestyle to express their anger. It's what some see as the seeds of a new social change movement, with under-25s at the forefront. Van Jones runs a think tank called Rebuild the Dream, which focuses on economic issues for young people. He says that historically, most change movements in the U.S. have been led by youth.
Emmett Till and his murder in the 1950s really created the consciousness among his generation, and that became the 60s civil rights movement.
For this generation, the tools may be different, but Jones says it was youth who brought the Trayvon case into the spotlight to begin with.
There would have never been a Trayvon Martin movement. We had never heard of the case, except that young people used social media to push the issue.
Jones cites an online petition started by Trayvon Martin's parents with Change.org calling for Zimmerman to be arrested and charged for their son's death. It spread quickly, mostly by young people on social media. The petition got over 2 million signatures. 6 weeks after Trayvon Martin's death, Zimmerman was arrested. And given the jury's verdict, Van Jones doesn't think these youth are going to drop their activism now.
I think that people coming to consciousness now about Trayvon's murder are getting themselves organized. I think that you're going to see an avalanche now of young people demanding a change in the criminal justice system.
Historically, youth change movements have had to educate themselves on the issues, what Jones calls consciousness building.
What I want to ask them first when we start up with a Trayvon Martin campaign is, What were they doing, or where were they at when the verdict came down?
That's exactly what a multiracial group of college students on the Cal State LA campus is in the midst of planning.
Their feelings are. I think it's important for the general public to know.
A group called Mother's Day Radio has been meeting regularly with African American and Latino high school students this summer, giving them media literacy and cultural literacy training. Chanel Curry runs the group.
We work with college students, and they create these engaging workshops, and they're going to be working with students with Peace Over Violence for their summer institute and helping them to create a campaign. If they were to create an advocacy campaign to address this issue, what would it look like?
It's about turning raw emotion into a targeted campaign that might actually affect change, says college senior Nerada Jacobo. Something she learned in her liberal studies major at Cal State that she wants to pass on to kids not yet in college.
By doing this, we're not forgetting about, you know, those communities, those high school students that really need, you know, other leaders like us as well as other people of color to come and talk to them and let them know that, you know, this is our country too and that we deserve to be respected.
Curry said the Trayvon Martin case has given them something specific to rally around.
Taking that passion, taking those tears, taking the feelings that they have about it and putting it into activism, making action happen, you know, making change happen.
That change could be big picture, like attempting to reform the criminal justice system, or joining with the NAACP to circulate a new petition to have Zimmerman tried by the Justice Department. The Cal State group will figure out its plan of action in meetings and trainings over the coming days. For the California Report, I'm Deepa Fernandez in Los Angeles.
We've had some record-setting heat around the state this summer. It's more than just an annoyance for those who can't take refuge because the outdoors is their office. Recently, when temperatures in California soared above 100 for almost 3 weeks, three farm workers died. As Lisa Morehouse reports, state regulators are investigating those deaths to see if employers violated laws designed to prevent heat illness.
At HMC Farms outside the Central Valley town of Selma, crews move up and down ladders picking nectarines. Between rows, a tractor carries bins to collect the fruit and a big cooler of water. 22-year-old Eduardo Amezcua empties a sack of nectarines, then grabs a paper cup and pours himself some water.
They tell us to drink every 15 minutes. Yeah, it's hitting the triple digits, so they tell us to work slow or, you know, where the shade's at and drink water frequently, yeah. Like it says right here. Rest in the shade. Wear
he points to a list of protections printed right on the side of the cooler. The farm also shortens work hours, especially in high heat. Today, the temperature will reach 107. So the crew started working at 5:30 in the morning and will quit by 1. Amezcua says years ago, they worked longer hours, even in high heat.
But then they got a little bit more stricter on having the people out here, like, working while it's too hot. So they got more, more laws or to take care of us.
In 2006, after a rash of fatalities, California became the first state to adopt heat illness regulations. Employers must provide water and shade and allow breaks. They need to train workers and supervisors and have an emergency plan for each location. Ranch manager Drew Kettleson says it makes business sense. Workers aren't very productive if it's hot or if they're sick. But he says it also makes moral sense.
The humanity part comes first because these guys do all the work and get us our product that we need to sell. And without these guys, you know, where are we? We're nowhere. So we do everything we can to take care of them.
Give Kashkuli is with the United Farm Workers.
We have seen some employers, lots of employers, now in compliance, and that's made the lives of tens of thousands of people really significantly better.
But he says all heat illness fatalities could be avoided.
These employers who just refuse to do basic things like water and shade, and that's enormously painful. Both the Schwarzenegger administration and the Brown administration have failed in that regard, and large numbers of employers are not complying.
As many as one out of every four farms inspected by the state's regulatory agency, Cal OSHA. The UFW has filed lawsuits against Cal OSHA. It wants stricter regulations, like requiring breaks, not just encouraging them. And Kashkouli says the state's 200 inspectors can't adequately enforce protections for California's estimated 600,000 farm workers, who are often undocumented and migratory.
Obviously, government can't be everywhere, can't be at every possible outdoor work site.
Ellen Whitus is chief of Cal OSHA. She says the agency sends inspectors out to sites based on work cycles and weather patterns. It also responds to complaints and reports of fatalities. After one man died in early July, Cal OSHA shut down all outdoor operations at his employer, Etchegaray Farms, citing multiple violations. Whitus says while Cal OSHA's data show a decrease in fatalities since 2006,
we're concerned where there are violations, even if there are no deaths or illnesses, because those kinds of violations could lead to illnesses and death.
Cal OSHA mounted a major multilingual heat illness awareness campaign on billboards across the state. And partners with growers, universities, and labor advocates to train employers and workers. On a blistering hot day in Imperial County, Lupe Quintero from California Rural Legal Assistance holds a workshop. Participants role play some scenarios, like confronting a crew boss about not having enough water. Farm worker Ana Reyes says this workshop taught her about her rights and where to file a complaint about inadequate heat protections if necessary.
I do have family members that have been victims of it. It wasn't until recently that proper shade became a requirement.
Reyes says when her employer provided training, it was rushed and hard to hear, but she had to sign a paper saying she'd been educated about heat stress. Organizer Lupe Quintero says everyone should try to imagine the same conditions in their own work lives.
Just think about it. If you're working in an office, somebody tries to stop you from drinking water, taking a break. I mean, you just take these things for granted. Well, why not for the farm worker?
Cal OSHA says it'll take about 6 months to finish investigating this summer's farm worker fatalities. For the California Report, I'm Lisa Morehouse.
Sometime in the next few weeks, the largest solar power plant of its kind anywhere will open in California's Mojave Desert. Electricity from the Ivanpah Solar Project will find its way to people throughout the state, moving us closer to California's ambitious renewable energy goal. But the project was no slam dunk, bogged down by controversy over an elusive herbivore. And as KQED science reporter Lauren Summer explains, if this renewable energy revolution is to really take off, conservationists and solar companies need to agree on a way forward.
If you want to look at what could be the future of California's energy, this is the place. I'm on top of a 400-foot concrete tower in the middle of the Mojave Desert.
Wow, this is crazy.
They're close to 200,000 meters below me, glimmering across a dry, dusty valley. We're just outside of the California-Nevada state line.
It's very exciting.
That's Dave Beaudoin, construction manager for the $2.2 billion Ivanpah project, originally developed by Oakland-based BrightSource Energy. Each mirror below is about the size of a garage door, and it's mounted on a pole so it can be pointed at the tower.
We can keep the sun's energy, the rays of the sun, targeted back to the solar tower.
So if these were all pointed at us right now,
it'd be very warm.
Warm, meaning it would be 1,000 degrees where we're standing. This isn't the solar technology that most of us think of, those dark silicon solar panels on rooftops. This is a solar thermal plant. The mirrors heat a giant boiler on top of this tower where water turns into steam. That steam powers a turbine, which makes electricity. There are three towers here, which will make enough power for about 140,000 homes.
Well, this is definitely cutting edge. It's nothing that I've ever done before. We're pretty excited about it. Can't you tell?
Bodwine, if you couldn't tell, is pretty level-headed, which may have come in handy on the bumpy road this project has had. It took years to get permits from almost a dozen state, federal, and local agencies. The project became political fodder after getting a federal loan guarantee, just like the bankrupt solar company, Solyndra. And then there's the desert tortoise, the issue that Ivanpah has become famous for.
I didn't have gray hairs before this project.
Doug Davis is the compliance manager for the project, but his title could also be tortoise babysitter. We're looking at a large mesh enclosure outside all the mirrors, what he calls tortoise head start.
Head start facility is mainly for the small guys. Their shells are very soft, so very susceptible to ravens.
These young tortoises were found on site here. They're a threatened species, so when they're big enough, they'll be relocated off-site. The company planned on finding just 35 desert tortoises, but came up with five times that number. That meant shutting down construction and doing another biological survey.
Almost every foot of our 3,500 acres, approximately, has been covered by a biologist at least 10 times.
The relocation project has come at a cost, $55,000 per tortoise. It's been watched closely by critics like Eileen Anderson.
I'm not a big fan of the super large projects.
Anderson is with the Center for Biological Diversity, one of the groups concerned over the loss of desert habitat. She says after California set a goal of getting a third of its electricity from renewable sources by 2020, there was a rush to build big solar farms in the desert.
Many of the projects, when they were first proposed and we would see the application, see where the map was, it was just like, oh, no, this is going to be a nightmare project.
But according to the state, the whole point of building renewable projects is to slow the pace of climate change, something that could harm the tortoise in the long run. Anderson doesn't buy it.
Well, even if we paved the whole California desert with solar plants, it's not going to save the planet.
Not everyone in the environmental community is on the same page.
If you care about desert tortoises, you better care about climate change.
Carl Zakella is with the Natural Resources Defense Council.
Without some large-scale renewable energy projects, we do not hit our climate goals. We do not replace fossil fuels with clean energy in this country.
These differing views created an uncomfortable debate, green versus green, between those who wanted to file lawsuits and those who didn't want to see solar developers driven away.
I think it has been tough. It's been personally painful. We are very good at stopping things. We aren't very good at building things.
In the end, with the threat of lawsuits in the air, environmental groups negotiated with the Ivanpah Project and other developers one by one to set aside nature preserves in the desert. Learning from this, the state is now trying to forge a smoother path for future solar projects. The idea is to divvy up the desert into renewable energy zones and zones that are off limits. Karen Douglas of the California Energy Commission says it's unusual to see all sides working together.
There is never any perfect consensus, but we've got an opportunity with this partnership to put in place, you know, what we really think of as the green print that will help us conserve our desert resources.
Douglas says a number of other Western states are watching California's effort. The Ivanpah Solar Project will come fully online by the end of the year. For the California Report, I'm Lauren Sommer.
From Jan and Dean to Katy Perry, the beach has long been the go-to setting for songs about California. But where some see surf and sun, Jesse Rutherford of The Neighborhood longs for the blessed chill of the fog. As our California Songs series continues, Rutherford talked to reporter Guy Marzorati about the virtues of sweater weather.
I grew up in Newbury Park, California. It's like a little suburban area, about 40 minutes outside of Los Angeles. I don't know, I always didn't necessarily see eye to eye with everybody and kind of had my own opinions on things, which, you know, I also found the people within that community, within that neighborhood that I was able to vibe out with, and that's kind of who I've kept close to me.
And all I am is a man. I want the world in my hands. I hate the beach, but I stay. Head in the clouds.
mean, I say in the song I hate the beach, because I actually do. First of all, the water's never warm. I don't care what anybody says. The water's not warm at the beach. It's beautiful, don't get me wrong. It's a gorgeous thing to see. I'll sit and look at it all day. I'll sit on the sand and look at it. I don't mind that, but I don't like the rest of it. And also, the beach is associated with relaxing and vacation. And you go there for the most part to get away from everything. And I don't like that. I don't like relaxing. I don't believe in vacations. I'm 21 years old. There's no reason I should have a vacation. I should be working harder than I ever have in my life. Both your hands in the holes of my sweater. And if I may just take your breath away. I don't mind if there's not much to say. Sometimes the silence guides the mind to move to a place so far away. The goosebumps start to raise the minute that my left hand meets your waist. I mean, all I listen to is hip-hop. Like, that's, like, all my influence. I don't really like rock music. So everything that, like, I'm influenced from is hip-hop, rap, that kind of stuff. Inside this place is warm. Outside it starts to pour. Coming down, one love, two mouths. One love, one house. No shirt, no blouse. Just us, you find out. Nothing that we don't want to tell you about. No. I legitimately got the idea from, like, I think I was with my ex-girlfriend or something, and like we both had our sweatshirts like this or whatever, and like, you know, you grab her arm and like she puts it like inside of the hole of your sweat. Like, that's how I got the idea of saying that. I think the melody was there first, and then the idea kind of came about, and I was like, yeah, that's kind of cool. That works. Why not? Sure, being from California, it's not cold really ever, but like it is sometimes. Like at nighttime, it gets chilly. I mean, I don't know. It was cold last night. Sweater Weather was the thing that, like, made all of this come together. Like, that song made the band. That song created the band. Like, we weren't a band before we wrote the song. We were just buddies. Like, we're all really good friends. Kirk, our manager, said, Jesse, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I want to, you know, be with my friends, and I want to make music with my friends because I don't want to be alone. And my friends are really talented. So that's how Sweater Weather came about, and that's how the band came about. 'Cause it's too cold.
That's Jesse Rutherford of The Neighborhood talking about Sweater Weather. It's one of the tracks on their album, I Love You. You can hear more of the California Songs series at californiareport.org. Winemakers will tell you that wine is created not so much in the cellar as in the vineyard, and that a connection to the land is vital to their craft. For Native American winemaker Tara Gomez, that connection goes back thousands of years. She's a member of the Santa Ynez Band of the Chumash and also the winemaker for Kita, the tribe's new winery. Reporter Diane Bach brings us the story from the Central Coast.
We'll go ahead and start off on this far end. So our number one selling on this vineyard is Grenache Blanc.
Tara Gomez and assistant winemaker Timory LeRae drive a pickup truck past rows of well-tended grapes.
Good morning.
Hi, Ben. Good morning.
Ben. How's it going?
Good.
Good. Are you guys going to cruise around that way?
We're going to come up to the mesa. Oh,
the two winemakers meet up with Ben Mertz. He's their vineyard manager. Mertz knows this land well. He grew up just a mile down the road.
We're farming the vineyard on a sustainable basis, and that means we monitor the blocks. We really don't treat for any kind of pest or diseases until we've hit certain thresholds. It proposes maybe a few more challenges out in the vineyard, or you have to be on your toes a bit more. That's our philosophy, and you know, that starts with Tara and the tribe, and we carry it through. So we're proud of that.
The tribe's Camp 4 vineyard is located in the gentle hills of the eastern San Ynez Valley. The name is a holdover from the old stagecoach days, back when this was the fourth stop on the route from San Francisco to Yuma. The property is studded with ancient oaks. Their thick, knotted limbs and low, wide canopies seem to keep close watch over the vines. In the distance is Grass Mountain, a peak that's sacred to the Chumash.
As our culture and our tribe, it's a balance between ourselves and our surroundings. in grape growing. It's finding that balance between the soil, the climate, the geographic region. In actual winemaking, it's finding that balance between the structure, the acidity, the actual fruit. So balance is kind of everything to us.
Gomez became intrigued with winemaking at an early age. As a kid, she would tag along when her parents went wine tasting in the valley. This was just as the area was becoming a wine destination.
I still remember very distinctly the smell, the aromatics of coming from the cellar, of the juice as it's fermenting, and seeing the lab. And, you know, that was kind of my cue that, you know, this is probably something that I want to get into. And sure enough, in high school, I knew that that was the direction I wanted to follow.
Armed with a knack for science and a tribal scholarship, Gomez headed to Fresno State to study enology. After graduation, she returned to the Central Coast and worked her way up through the ranks of the area wineries. In 2010, when the Chumash acquired the Camp 4 parcel, they hired Gomez to be their consultant.
I was able to convince them to at least get me a few tons of fruit to experiment with.
The winery is the latest venture for the Chumash, who have thrived since opening a controversial casino resort in the rural town of Santa Ynez in 2004. With Quita, the tribe joins the ranks of a small number of California's Native American-owned wineries, with the distinction of being the only one with a tribal member at the helm.
There you go.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
At the release party for the Quita label, an appreciative crowd of wine industry insiders swirls and sips from that very first 2010 vintage.
Fabulous. I think it's incredible.
Linda Spencer is with the Yoshadihi Wintun Nation. She traveled from Northern California to support the Chumash and sample the five wines.
I'm only halfway through it so far. I'm working my way through slowly, but it's wonderful.
Joe Barton owns Gray Wolf Winery in nearby Paso Robles.
It's nice. It's a good tannin, little blackberry. Not too toasty. I like the woods there, but it's not too over the top. It's pretty integrated. I like it.
They say it dances on your tongue. Titillates the senses.
Wine rep Mackenzie Miller pours a Sauvignon Blanc.
It speaks so much to just the native land, Quita meaning our valley oak in the Somali language. You know, it all just goes back to planting deep roots and watching them grow. And I think that is just the Chumash way.
Enjoying a taste of Syrah for the California Report, I'm Diane Bach on the Central Coast.
And that's the California Report, production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director is Susie Racho. The technical producer is Seal Muller, with additional engineering from Howard Gelman. The online team includes Lisa Pickoff-White, David Marks, and Don Clyde. Our interns are Rachel Marcus and Carly Naren. Our editorial team includes Victoria Malion, Ingrid Becker, Bruce Kuhn, and Raul Ramirez. I'm Craig Miller. Enjoy the weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. The California Teachers Association, celebrating 150 years of advocating for all students, educators, and California's public schools and colleges. And the California Endowment. Health happens with prevention at calendow.org.